From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal is on track to become our new law. What does it mean for Michigan farmers?
It's good news. It causes everyone to breathe a bit of a sigh of relief.
Plus, one acquittal plus a mistrial. What now for State Rep Larry Inman?
I certainly will ask the Speaker to reinstate my office and my staff and my assignments.
Helping new moms through postpartum blues and depression.
A mother can't give what she doesn't have. So if she's not feeling loved and supported and well, she's not going to be able to make her baby feel loved and supported and well.
And the Bay City firm that sold kit houses by catalog.
We have farm-to-table dining, and their shtick was forest to home.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. And now, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Experts estimate that postpartum mood disorders like anxiety and depression impact as many as 1 in 5 mothers. Later in the program, we talk about how stigma stops many women from seeking treatment. But first, House Democrats and the White House have struck a deal on the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the USMCA. Tuesday's announcement gives President Trump a win, and House Dems show they're still legislating amidst the impeachment inquiry. So let's talk about what this could mean for Michigan's farmers and growers as we welcome Jim Byram, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. So, Jim, we're hearing the House will vote on this by the end of the year. Then the USMCA goes to the Senate. Is it good news for Michigan farmers?
Well, it's good news. It's good news for agriculture. It's good news for lots of industries because, Cynthia, quite frankly, the fear of the president withdrawing us from NAFTA had a lot of folks on edge. But by adopting USMCA, which is has the president's fingerprints all over it, I mean, he drove the negotiations. That's a win. That breeds some confidence that the agreement will be in place, that we'll maintain our relationships with our two top trading partners. So that's absolutely critical. It's good news. It causes everyone to breathe a bit of a sigh of relief.
Remind us again, as you mentioned, our two top trading partners. What do the Mexican and Canadian markets mean for Michigan's food and agricultural products?
They mean virtually everything, all the way from dry beans to dairy for Mexico and everything in between, a lot of fruit crops, and certainly NAFTA has enabled us, the apple producers, for example, to access that market. Canada, right next door, we sell everything to Canada, everything you can imagine agriculturally, and they, of course, reciprocate and sell some stuff here as well. But in terms of trade and access, you know, the busiest border crossing in the world is actually Windsor. I think the second or third or fourth busiest crossing is actually one leaving Texas into Mexico. Mm. So just those two facts just demonstrate how important trade is, how important agriculture and other manufactured goods and other products between the trade between those two countries and the United States is just absolutely critical. Any disruption would have been devastating.
Jim, from what you're hearing, what are you hearing that might be the key differences between the new and the old, the USMCA and NAFTA?
Well, the key differences, the most obvious, are that there's an update of a very old trade agreement. NAFTA's been around a long time, and there were some provisions that were put in it that today are antiquated, for example. We can now use, under USMCA, we can use electronic documents, electronic verifications, transmittals electronically, as opposed to carrying hard paper copies of all documents. You know, that's important. Just brings it into the 21st century, hopefully. So that's important. There's going to be some difference, perhaps, in the class 7 milk that has been impacting the United States, Michigan farmers from Canada. So there's some changes, but basically it just reinforces the agreement that's been around for a long time. Most of the provisions and titles haven't really changed that much.
Yeah, in fact, I know there have been some who've kind of called it NAFTA light, but I guess so. It sounds like what I'm hearing you say is it's getting updated, but it's not blowing up what our farmers and growers have known for these years.
Really, it just reinforces the relationships that we've had for a long, long time, and that's important. It makes the commerce easier, which is good. It hopefully makes some dispute resolution easier, which is good. And you know, those are problems that have surfaced from time to time, and simplifying those processes is important. But all in all, it just as I say, breeds confidence that at least we're going to have a good, long-standing, established trade relationship with at least Mexico and Canada. Unfortunately, around the world, we've had other challenges, so it's good to see some confidence between these three trading partners.
It has been a bruising year for Michigan growers. We've certainly covered it on this program. You know, the weather certainly unkind and hurting harvests. And so what is a new year with this new trade deal in place once it gets through Congress and looking good for that? And certainly the president's going to be happy to sign that. What will this mean in the new year for Michigan farmers and growers?
Well, it's a signal of good news, and good news has been hard to come by, as you say, Cynthia, the last 12 months. It's been a tough year for agriculture. Some of the trade issues between China, the EU, and elsewhere, even Brazil and Argentina now, have caused some prices to be depressed. So this is good news that at least we have one in place. We have the new USMCA in place. Hopefully that bodes well for Chinese negotiations, even the EU negotiations, French negotiations, and others, so we can get back to trading with some of our traditional trading partners. It's been a tough year. And if the president goes forth with this, we'll be in good shape and at least have something to ring in the new year with good news.
Jim Byron, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. Jim, thank you.
Cynthia, pleasure to be with you.
To learn more about what the USMCA means for the auto industry, tune in tomorrow during Morning Edition with Doug Trabu right here on Michigan Radio. State Representative Larry Inman has avoided what could have been up to 20 years in prison. The week-long trial of the Traverse City Republican ended with the jury finding him not guilty of lying to the FBI and deadlocked on two other counts of soliciting a bribe and extortion. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnson covered the trial in Grand Rapids. So, Max, 12 hours of jury deliberation and a mistrial?
Yes, yeah, sort of. So Inman was found not guilty on one of the three charges, that's lying to the FBI. The jury couldn't agree on a verdict on the other two charges, so it's a partial acquittal and a partial mistrial. Multiple people, including Inman's attorney Chris Cook, who's been practicing the law for at least 30 years, said they've never seen anything quite like this in this case. It was only the second mistrial in the 12-year federal court career of the federal judge on the case. So it's safe to say no one really saw this coming.
So remind us just what the charges were about.
Yeah, so Inman was accused of trying to sell his vote on Michigan's prevailing wage law last year. To summarize, prosecutors said that he asked lobbyists for campaign cash over text message in exchange for his support on prevailing wage. Then when the FBI investigated it, prosecutors said he lied to an FBI agent when they asked him if he ever made that offer.
What did Inman and his attorney say about these results?
Well, they were frankly giddy when this was announced. Inman was visibly relieved. He let out a huge sigh when the mistrial and acquittal was announced. After court adjourned, he and his attorney were thrilled. I mean, I hadn't really seen them smile at any point during the trial, but they were all smiles afterwards. Here's some brief comments that Inman and his attorney made to reporters after court let out.
I'm hopefully looking forward to, getting back in stream with my job and working with the other legislators and doing good for the residents of Grand Traverse County.
He holds no grudges. He proved himself. So I think people will accept him back. So.
And Inman is an attorney who you also heard there. Both called for the representative to have his office, staff, and committee assignments restored to him. Those were removed after the indictment was announced earlier this year. Overall, Inman was really happy after the verdict. This has been a week-long trial where his character was questioned, where a lot of nasty things were said about him by his colleagues, and it was evident every day how stressed he was. This is one of the only times after the trial let out that I've seen him smile and sort of relax since this whole court began.
Max, is there any indication the prosecution plans to try again?
It seems they will. Right after the mistrial was announced, the prosecuting attorney asked the judge to set a new trial date on the remaining two charges. Remember, a mistrial doesn't mean that he can't be tried again. He still can. And that indictment still stands. So Inman is still also under a couple bond conditions. He can't leave the state. So it looks like he may be tried again. But, this case is really complicated. So it's not a guarantee that prosecutors will be able to go back. But he could be back on trial soon.
So when Representative Inman was on the stand, what kind of defense did he offer?
Well, as to the text messages that prosecutors pointed to charge him on these counts, Immin insists he doesn't remember sending them. There was lots of talk about his use of opioid painkillers. At one point, he testified that he was taking up to 20 to 25 Norco pills a day and drinking heavily. That's, by the way, 20 to 25 pills of Norco. That's a tremendous amount of drugs.
Yes, that is.
And that's on top of the stress Immin said he was under for a tight reelection campaign. He said that all clouded his judgment. He doesn't remember sending those text messages. He thinks they may be misinterpreted. On his prevailing wage vote specifically, Immin said the only thing that factored into his vote was political pressure from other Republicans and conversations he had with his constituents. He says money from lobbyists never really impacted his vote, and as evidence of that, he pointed to a check from lobbyists that he returned to a union after he didn't vote their way on prevailing wage. So there was a lot of conversation about all that. And then in closing statements, his attorney said no one ever saw Immin ask for a bribe in person. He said this was only done over text message and warned the jury not to convict someone based on a text message alone, whose meaning they don't necessarily know.
What might this mean for that recall effort against the representative?
Yeah, that's tricky. The petition was thrown out a couple weeks ago by state officials because of a few typos, but the people behind that petition are trying to challenge that in court. They don't want those signatures to go out the window based on, you know, some typos in there. But they did use the language of the indictment against Immin in their petition. Now, those charges are still pending. That indictment still stands, but this case is, and those charges are not nearly as clear as they seemed a couple weeks ago. So as far as the law is concerned, Representative Immin is still an innocent man. So when they do challenge that petition being tossed out, it may be a tough sell to a judge. And the reality is plenty of people are still upset at Immin. We've seen that reaction after all these stories have gone up. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's still an effort to remove him from office.
So do we know if now he can get back to the business of being the representative for the 104th District?
Well, he's back in session today. The House is in session. He is in Lansing. I've seen that on social media. Here's Immin on his future in Lansing.
I certainly will ask the Speaker to reinstate my office and my staff and my assignments as though, the moment before the indictment came out. So,
now, this is just my educated guess, but for productivity's sake, I would imagine he'll get his office and staff back. Just for practicality's sake, the committee assignments may be a tough sell. Immin insists he still has friends in the Capitol and wants to tackle specifically addiction issues in light of, you know, what he said were his struggles with opioids over the past few years. It's tough to know how he'll be received because there were some very frank conversations during the trial about his behavior. But for now, Immin seems kind of unfazed.
Max Johnson, Interlochen Public Radio. Max, thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Coming up, our friends at the Michigan History Center take us back to a time before internet shopping when you could order anything from a catalog, including build-it-yourself homes. That's next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
Christmas is 2 weeks from today. And of course, pre-internet, shoppers would scramble to local stores or they would pore over catalogs in those final days leading up to the holiday. Catalog shopping, you had to be organized. It required skill and planning, filling out order forms and worrying about delivery timelines and if any inventory remained when they got your order. Certainly online shopping has changed all of that, but let's talk about back in 1906. Did you know a Michigan company was the first to offer shoppers a catalog of ready-to-assemble homes shipped to their soon-to-be doorstep? Here to tell us more about this pioneering retailer is state archivist Mark Harvey. So, Mark, 1906 seems a little early for prefabricated homes. Well, tell us about Aladdin Homes.
It's very early. As you said, they were the first. They were a company out of Bay City. Two brothers, Otto and William Sovereign, great names. Mm. They named the company Aladdin because Otto, the consummate marketer, referenced the Aladdin and his magic lamp story where the genie produced a castle overnight. So that was their shtick. William was the dreamer. Otto was newspaper man and marketer. So they started marketing this right away. They got the idea because William had seen something called the Defoe Boat Company, and they did mail order boats that you would build. So that's where they got the idea from. But really, it's It's really early. 1906 is really early for this concept.
Absolutely. So how prefabricated were these homes? I mean, what happens when your bungalow in a box shows up?
There's a lot of great documentation online, examples of current owners that have all of the records and letters from the company, but they would literally walk you right through. You know, we have YouTube videos now to walk us through how to do the task. They would walk you through letter by letter. They would say, here's the foundation plan. And then they would ship the lumber and all the exterior materials with kind instructions and then the interior and so on. And then there's some great correspondence as late as the 1950s from still Otto Sovereign writing to people where they had finished their house and sent him a picture. And he was so thrilled that he sent them flower boxes for their front window because he thought it would just look a little bit nicer. So he sent them flower boxes at no charge.
Okay, I'm loving that. I am loving that. So this is kind of, I suppose, the closest thing I'm thinking about is like you go to IKEA and you take the huge box home with the the pull-out sofa bed and you try to do that. That's a big enough thing. It's amazing to think of, here is your home in a box.
I think the key, though, is, you know, IKEA is famous for confounding people with construction, and Aladdin was all about service in this idea of really connecting with their customers. We have farm-to-table dining, and their shtick was forest to home.
Wow. What created this market for kit homes, Mark?
I think you can look at a lot of different factors, including 1906 and in the teens, there's a real movement for craftsmanship, and this really democratized the ability for every person to build their own home, even though it came, you know, with dimensional lumber and instructions. We didn't have the proliferation of builders like we do now. You drive down the highway and you see a million billboards for for builders and subdivisions, et cetera.
Sure.
And so they were really on the cutting edge of this demand for housing that was growing in America. You know, they took a hit with the Depression, but they got wartime contracts, and then there was a severe housing shortage after World War II that really stayed them into the early 1980s.
We baby boomers, when we arrived, they needed houses for
us. That's right.
Did Aladdin, this Bay City company, did it have competition elsewhere?
Yeah, a couple years after they came on the market, maybe more popular are the Sears kits homes. Everybody's heard of those, maybe.
Yes.
And Montgomery Ward's had them. Actually, in Bay City, there were two other kit home companies, Sterling and later Liberty, that were building homes. They actually did some of the manufacturing early on for Aladdin, but then went off on their own. So Bay City alone had three kit home companies.
Why do you think that is? What was it about Bay City that, you know, you got three companies in the one town?
Historically, Bay City, Saginaw is historically famous lumbering area. It's near water transport, and you're still getting forest products coming out of northern Michigan.
Fair enough. Any large-scale communities that were basically all Aladdin homes?
Yeah, there's a couple of really fun ones of note. Hopewell, Virginia, which was a DuPont company town, were all Aladdin homes. And then in Birmingham, England, the Austin Motor Company built their workers' village out of all Aladdin homes.
So these went outside of the U.S.?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. So how long did Aladdin last, and kind of what led to its demise?
1906 was their starting date, as we mentioned, through 1981. And I think you can see that arc. Anyone that lived through the 80s knows that it was a time of high housing costs, and they had sort of reached the end of that do-it-yourself component of the market of kit homes. And we're seeing a resurgence of that now with tiny homes and energy-efficient homes.
Yes.
But for what they were doing, you know, going from bungalows to then later ranch homes, it had really met its market cycle.
It makes me wonder, as you know, you mentioned the tiny home movement. Certainly, it's being used in Detroit by the Cass Community Services, where they have put up tiny homes for people who were previously homeless. But it makes you kind of wonder, we are seeing this kind of drive to go back to simplicity, and I wonder, would we ever see these kit homes come back in the market? People who really do want to do it themselves, or the people who want to live off the grid?
I think we'll see it in a smaller scale, or we're experiencing it in smaller scale now. I doubt we would see entire communities being built by kit homes. A fun story is what happened to the records of the company after they went out of business. A gentleman in Bay City was renting a warehouse, and in the corner was a whole pile of records, which turned out to be the entire company records for Aladdin Homes. And they were donated to the Clark Historical Library. And they detail everyone's purchases of these homes and full color catalogs that are all available online at the Clark Historical Library.
It makes me wonder if people who are listening to us could be living in one of these homes and not know it.
Yeah, probably.
So just think about that. 1906, you could have got into the catalog and bought yourself a home for the holidays. Mark Harvey, Michigan History Center, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The birth of a new baby is an exciting time. Grandparents and family come over to fawn over the new baby, pass the little one around. But what happens when a mom doesn't feel that same joy, when she actually feels disconnected from the excitement around her? It can be a deeply isolating feeling, but it's far from uncommon. Experts say as many as 1 in 5 women experience mood disorders before and after giving birth. Here to talk about perinatal mood disorders is Dr. Maria Music, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Michigan. Dr. Music also runs the Zero to Thrive program, giving social and emotional support to families with young children. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
My kids are 35 and 25, and I do remember hearing about the baby blues, I'm using air quotes here, back then. Has the prevalence or incidence gone up in those decades?
So I'm so glad you're bringing up baby blues, because that was
the term.
And it's still the term. However, postpartum depression and baby blues are two very different things, and we need to emphasize that, and that's so important for me. So what is the baby blues? It's very common. It's almost a normative experience of women after the birth. There are major hormonal changes. The birth is a wonderful and exhausting experience, not only psychologically and bodily, but also hormonally. Mm. The hormones at the end of the pregnancy, estrogen, progesterone, are 100, 200 times higher than any time in a woman's life. And then within hours, it's going down to almost zero. So this is a hormonal roller coaster that leads to an emotional roller coaster. It should stabilize within a couple days or a week or maximum 2. 80 to 90% of women have this temporary mood instability in the first 2 weeks postpartum. It goes away. If it doesn't, then we are worried.
Then we're talking about these postpartum.
Over time, women might develop what we call postpartum depression. Mm. And that's a serious condition.
But women will tend to not express what's going on. So how can people around a new mom realize there is something more happening? This is going on longer if she's got her game face on, but inside she's not feeling right.
So I think what we need to look for is if she has persistent kind of low mood and maybe some irritability. Again, a little bit of irritability, a little bit of exhaustion is almost normative in those first couple of weeks. But if it becomes more, so mom is not enjoying at all herself or the baby.
And we're going beyond the couple-week period. That
and
sounds like it's kind of the real thing to watch for.
Absolutely. And actually the peak of postpartum depression, so what you have, depressed mood, irritability is actually more common than sadness and crying spells. Anxiety, worrisome intrusive thoughts, something bad is going to happen to the baby. I have to check on the baby all the time. Or I am not a good mom. Self-doubt, guilt. Maybe even thoughts of, I can't take it, I want to take off, I want to sleep forever, suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. All of that, the peak actually is around week 6, between week 6 and week 16. And it's so important that we don't lose sight of, it's not the first week or two. It's farther out when the woman does not have any OB visits anymore and is on her own.
When I think of OB visits and in the months leading up to and after I had my children, I don't remember anybody doing my obstetrician or the well baby checkups, the pediatrician. No fault on them. They were wonderful, but nobody ever said, how are you feeling? And now that was a few decades ago. Is that still the case? Do we need doctors to, these primary care physicians to kind of jump in and get involved?
So I think times have changed, and I'm very glad about that. And, we all work together, the moms, the families, and the health professionals. Right now, I would say for the last 10, 15 years, we have systematic screening in pregnancy and early postpartum where measures that are validated are used to actually check in with mom. How are you doing? And then the physicians, the nurses, the midwives, they can review the screener with the mom and check in with her what's going on. It's not consistently across the country and not in Michigan, but I think we're doing pretty okay. Of course, the obstetricians who know the mom and have been with her across pregnancy and now have this relationship, by week six, it's the last visit. So then she might fall off. But again, the good news is there's a new era within the pediatricians. We call it now the fourth trimester. Mm-hmm. Pediatricians have recognized that this is a mother-baby unit in the first year postpartum. The baby cannot be well alone. And so pediatricians have started to screen as well.
Dr. Music, especially for women who are feeling these mood disorders while they're pregnant. All right, so we know that there's a lot of concern among women while they're pregnant about even having coffee, let alone medication. So what do we know about how, for example, antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications might impact the health of a child?
Again, I'm so glad you're bringing this up because that's one of the biggest worries, right? Moms are told, you know, don't do this, don't do that, and you might harm the baby. And at the same time, we know if mom doesn't feel well and she's stressed out, is depressed or very anxious and flooded by her stress hormone in her body, that goes through the placenta and that impacts the developing baby as well. So actually, untreated illness is the most detrimental to the mom's health and the baby's health. Related to preterm birth, low birth weight, small for gestational age in the baby. So you have to contrast that. If I don't treat versus if I treat safely. Mm-hmm. And of course, the best treatments and the most researched and validated are psychosocial treatments, behavioral interventions, cognitive interventions. We have wonderful psychotherapies that are validated in pregnancy.
But are medications sometimes called for?
And at the same time, and I wanted to come to this, for some moms, psychotherapy might not be the solution.
Yeah.
There might be no access or she might not respond so well. Or the illness might be too advanced. And in that regard, we have safe medicines, antidepressants, anti-anxiety, mood stabilizers that have been now researched for 25 some years. And actually, psychopharmaca are the best studied medicines in pregnancy. There is no other medicine, no antibiotic, no sleeping aid, nor allergy medicine that has been so much studied than any antidepressants. And so we actually know, when you look at all the meta-reviews and meta-analyses of hundred thousands of data, we know that these medicines are safe.
And how does untreated mental illness in a mother affect that very important relationship?
Yeah, so we have actually, again, many, many longitudinal studies now that support that untreated illness in the mom has ramifications, negative ramifications to not only herself, other family members, so also for the partners. We know that 30% of dads, if the mom is depressed, become depressed too. And we also know that untreated illness has impact on brain development, in utero, changes birth outcomes, and then subsequently leads to less optimal parenting strategies, particularly in the context of additional adversities. Mm-hmm. So I also want to take away the blame that moms don't feel like, oh gosh, you
look
know
what I've done to my baby.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is a combination of multiple risks. So depression alone, and particularly if it gets treated in time, even in the first year of life, has no set in stone negative outcomes. But if it's combined with untreated, and then the mom is self-medicating, maybe with some substances, or is not taking care of herself, maybe she's in a really difficult psychosocial situation.
Quite a
some
cycle.
Trauma. It is just increasing that cycle.
Do you see these perinatal and postnatal mood disorders? Is there a difference in prevalence based on whether someone has had a previous history of mental illness?
So in some way, the risks for these conditions it's kind of like a multi-risk mm-hmm. model. The more risk factors you have, the more likely you are to really have one of these conditions after the birth or in pregnancy. One is definitely a hereditary, a genetic load. So if somebody in the family already has depression, or you yourself had a previous episode of depression or anxiety as a teenager or as already, you know, as a young adult, you might be more at risk. Or if you had previously anxiety or depression in pregnancy or postpartum with your previous child, you are more at risk to have it again. In fact, it gets a little bit more severe in symptomatic, but that doesn't mean you should decide against children. It just means please work with us
and have it ready.
And yeah, have your perinatal psychiatrist on board. So I tell moms when they work with me and when they ask me, can I have another child? I say, absolutely, but I am your coach. I am your coaching team. We are your team. Please call us early enough as you are planning your pregnancy. Come with your partner, the whole family, and we will coach you through. We are like your cheerleaders. We get you through, and it will be successful.
Dr. Maria Music, she's an associate professor of psychiatry and also obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Michigan, where she's the co-director of the Zero to Thrive program. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you for having me.
Being the parent of a newborn, it's overwhelming. For women struggling with a postpartum mood disorder, it can feel nearly impossible. The Grand Rapids group Moms Bloom aims to give vulnerable new moms a helping hand by pairing them with volunteers. The group is headed by Carrie Kohlhaus, and her work with this group was inspired by her own struggles after the birth of her son. Carrie, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me today.
There's this cultural narrative around birth. You've got this new baby. It's supposed to be the most wonderful, joyful time. And isn't this all great? Does that impact women's willingness to seek help for postpartum mood disorders?
Absolutely. There is a lot of guilt and shame around this disease because one of the largest expectations in life that we have is that we're supposed to be so grateful and joyful about parenting. And we're told our whole lives what a magical thing, you know, becoming a mother is. And so when women don't feel joyful and when the illness is getting in the way of their gratitude or their love or appreciation for their child, it's a really hard thing to admit. And so I think a lot of women are not speaking up. They're not even telling the truth to their doctors or their family members. And sometimes those family members and the people closest to us are actually the ones who are hardest to tell. And sometimes it's easier to tell a stranger. And so that's why I think that the Moms Bloom program is so magical and so necessary for allowing women the space to tell the truth and to get the support that they need.
And I know you come to this work out of your own experience with postpartum depression. Tell us what happened after the birth of your son.
Yeah, I have a 10-year-old son, and after I gave birth to him, it was really instantaneous. And I didn't realize that at the time because it was my first child and I had nothing to compare it to. But now that I've had another child and I've experienced it in a different way without postpartum depression, I now realize that something was really not right from the very start. And I had actually felt phenomenal as a pregnant woman. I felt happy. I felt full of life. And immediately after giving birth, I felt empty. I felt like an empty shell. And I just remember the nurses taking me to the shower. And I remember standing in the shower and thinking, my life is over. I've made a terrible mistake. Of course, that was nothing that I felt I could admit out loud.
What was the scariest part of that realization for you?
Well, having a child is irreversible. And it's a huge responsibility. When you feel loved and you're joyful about parenting, you're able to soar above the massive responsibility, the massive work of it all. But when you're in a dark place and you don't feel loved, you don't feel like you love yourself, and you're not well, you become kind of crushed by the burden and responsibility and work of it all.
And what finally, Carrie, sparked your decision to seek out help? How long did it take for you to do that?
It took me about 3 months. I was really in denial about what I was experiencing, and I didn't have the courage or the awareness to talk to any of my family members or even my doctor about what was happening. A woman came over. She was part of a breastfeeding program. She was encouraging and trying to support women to breastfeed longer. She was a complete stranger. I had never met her. And she came over to my house, and the minute she walked in the door, I just started crying and said, I don't know what's happening, but I am losing it, and I am not myself, and I don't understand what's happening. And she said, well, you know, I'm not a doctor, but it sounds to me like you might be suffering from postpartum depression, and I really think you should call your doctor. And being able to tell a stranger felt so safe, because she was going to leave that day, and maybe I was never going to have to talk to her again. And I wouldn't have to. I could go on in my denial if I wanted to. So then I did have the courage to call my doctor, and I was able to seek out therapy and, in my case, medication, and able to make a recovery. And once I did make a recovery, it was like I was seeing my baby with new eyes. I felt so different about motherhood and about my relationship with my baby. And I was able to bond with him in a very different way.
So Moms Bloom, this group that you head up, you're the executive director. How does Moms Bloom help women who are struggling with this kind of mood disorder after birth?
We provide them with loving support. And we do that by recruiting and training volunteers in our community. And then we match those volunteers with mothers who have reached out and asked for help. The moms who reach out to us might reach out while they're pregnant, just knowing that they are in a situation where they're going to need extra help because maybe they don't have a lot of family around, or they're having twins, or they're a single mom or a young mom, or they're at risk for a perinatal mood disorder because of a past mental illness. And so we send a volunteer to those women's homes once or twice a week for 3 months. It sounds really simple. I mean, the volunteer comes and they provide a listening ear, emotional support. They might help the mother get connected to other community resources that she needs, especially if she's suffering from a mental illness. And anything that she might need, whether it's mentoring her on how to take care of her baby or holding her baby so that she can take a nap and rest. I mean, at the end of the day, all these little things that the volunteer does are really just showing the mom that she's loved and supported and that she matters. There's so much focus on babies in our healthcare system and among our families and support systems. There's so much focus on the baby. There's not enough focus on mom. And a mother can't give what she doesn't have. So if she's not feeling loved and supported and well, she's not going to be able to make her baby feel loved and supported and well. So we really try to give her that love and support that she needs so that she can truly thrive as a person and as a mother.
We heard from Dr. Music telling us kind of what distinguishes the baby blues, which a big percentage of women experience, from true postpartum depression, which has mainly to do with the length of time. How long do volunteers from Moms Bloom work with moms?
We match them for about 3 months. Sometimes we extend the match if we feel like the mom is continuing to need some support. But otherwise, we try to make a warm handoff to other community resources that serve older babies. And especially if mom is suffering from a perinatal mood disorder, We try to get her connected with programs like the Pine Rest Mother Baby Program, support groups offered through the Maternal Wellness Program or through Spectrum Health, or we try to get her connected with a therapist. There are a lot of great providers in our community who specialize in perinatal mood disorders and can really help the women that we serve.
Carrie, do you think cultural attitudes or understanding about maternal mood disorders, has it shifted?
I do think that we're seeing a positive change as there's been more awareness. I think for many years, there's been a misconception about postpartum psychosis versus postpartum depression. You hear these really dramatic stories in the news about mothers who are, you know, harming them, their children or themselves. And more often than not, those are women who are suffering from postpartum psychosis. And I think because they've been mislabeled as postpartum depression, it's created a stigma that has made women afraid to speak up about having postpartum depression because they're afraid they'll be labeled as crazy or a harm to themselves or their baby, which is most often not the case for a woman who's suffering from PPD. So we are seeing a lot of positive movement. However, I think we have a really long ways to go. I'm still meeting with women all the time who are suffering from postpartum depression. The symptoms are obvious. The symptoms are strong. And they do not want to be labeled as being ungrateful or bad mothers or feel that they're failures. So I just want to encourage all of those women and any women who might be listening to this to be honest with themselves and to understand that this is a very common complication after childbirth. And the best thing that you can do for yourself and the best thing that you can do for your baby is to get yourself emotionally and mentally well.
Certainly, listening to you, knowing that you were in a very dark place after having your son those 10 years ago, you sought the help. And anyone listening to us talking right now who's going through this know that there can be a way through it.
Absolutely. I remember distinctly feeling like my life was over, that I was never going to be happy again. I was never going to achieve the things that I had wanted to achieve. And looking back, I just realized that I was just stuck in a really dark place. And I found my way out of it and have found so much joy in parenting. And my 10-year-old son is the light of my life. And I adore him. And he is such a gift. And I'm so glad that I got the help that I needed so that I could see that and experience that.
Carrie Kohlhaus is Executive Director of Moms Bloom. It's based in Grand Rapids. Carrie, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When 9-year-old Emma Hernandez was mauled to death by 3 pit bulls during the summer, it put Detroit's Animal Care and Control Department under a harsh and unforgiving spotlight, particularly with the revolving door of directors, 3 directors in only the past 4 years. Well, now the city has hired a new director, Mark Kumpf, and an assistant animal control director, Lori Soule. And they're with us now to talk about how they plan to turn this department around. Welcome to Stateside. It's really good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So, Mark, I know Emma's death happened before you accepted this job as animal care and control director. You know, the headlines were everywhere, and I'm wondering just how did what happened to that little girl help shape your motivation and your plans to fix what wasn't working?
The exciting thing about coming to Detroit Animal Care and Control was the opportunity to make a difference. And seeing how things had gone, I guess, poorly over the past few years, there were a lot of opportunities for improvement, especially in terms of public safety and animal care. And those were the things that really drew me to Detroit.
And Lori, I know you were with another department with the city. You were with fire. And so when that happened last summer, same question for you. How does that motivate you to fix this department?
You know, it's just, it saddened me that this poor little girl lost her life. The firefighters, you know, the EMS folks had to respond. So, you know, I kind of saw it from that perspective, being with the fire department and worried about the guys, you know, because they see some crazy things out there sometimes. And, I believe in helping. I believe in making a difference. And, you know, even though I was working with fire at the time, it's always been a mission for me to make things better, to make things better organized, to make our jobs easier, to make the citizens happy, because I'm a citizen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of nice to be able to be a part of that. I like to make differences. So it's that's what motivated me. It's we don't need this to happen. You need to be safe in the city.
Marcus, you figured out, came in, and you're figuring out how you want to reshape animal control and care in Detroit. What were the big problems you saw? What needed fixing the most?
Well, the city had already identified the most pressing issue, which is the fact that the animal shelter itself really is not up to where it needs to be to fulfill the mission. And the great thing about it, and what really drew me again, is Michigan is a center for this type of improvement. You know, the city of Detroit is putting the resources to both enhance staff as well as the physical facility to make it a viable operation.
So there are plans afoot for a new animal center, aren't they?
There were plans afoot before I arrived, and the city's committed over $3 million to the renovation and expansion of the existing facility. The staff is going to be doubled. We're going to have more animal care and control officers, more investigators that Lori will be supervising. We'll have more animal care staff. We brought on two veterinarians. And again, both sides of the house, we're essentially doubling staff. We're going from around 30 people to over 70.
So now you're restructuring the city's animal care and control efforts. And Lori Soule, you are the assistant animal control director, which means what? What are you responsible for?
Oh, I was responsible for the law enforcement side of the house, basically. I think when I started, there was about 9 control officers. We're now at 18 or 19, and we're headed to 23 for the city, control officers. And we didn't really have – we had one gentleman that was doing investigations for us, and now we're going to 7 investigators, so one for every district in the city, which is wonderful because they're going to be the point of contact for the city council members, and they'll be at community meetings, and we're going to be spreading, you know, information, education, those kinds of things about animal care and just, you know, the basic ordinances that are in place and, you know, how much a license is and, you know, all kinds of great information for the community that they don't currently have. And then the other thing that I'm actually responsible for is the call center, which is a fairly new resource we've put in place. We've extended our hours so people can call from 7 in the morning until 7 in the evening, and someone will pick up that phone.
Yes, that was a criticism. And I guess
right? We're answering them.
And we should mention that hotline is 313-922-DOGS.
That's correct. Yep, and it's super easy to remember. So, and you'll be seeing billboards across the city because there's a marketing campaign starting up, and so everybody will have the opportunity to be informed about it.
We have, you know, talked with animal rescue groups. We've seen reports of neighbors, even police officers who would call. In the past, they would call or turn up at animal control seeking help, and either no one would answer the phone or no one would answer the door. How will this restructuring address that?
We've got essentially a program where we have staff now that are responsive 7 days a week. The animal care and control folks are available from 7 to 7, 7 days a week. So there's officers and trucks out on the road. The call center is staffed 7 days so people can reach them during those regular business hours. We have an after-hours service for the police only that they can reach, and we have a person at the shelter that can accept animals from DPD officers. That's not for the general public. And our shelter is open from 10:30 to 3:30, 7 days a week, so folks can come down and find their lost pet, find an animal for adoption, purchase a city dog license.
Mark Kumpf is the director of Detroit Animal Care and Control, and Lori Soule, assistant animal control director. And one more time, we should just repeat that hotline number is 313-922-DOGS. If you're worried about one, if you've lost one, whatever dog issue in Detroit you've got, 313-922-DOGS. Thanks to both of you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.